the 81st or Wildcat Intradivision in France. After the war, he married Emily Hill, the daughter of a friend of our mother's. They had three children. David, Tom Jr., and Tish. As far as Tom was concerned, I just considered that he could do anything he put his mind to because he proved that very amply in the house that he built out of stone and so forth. I had the pleasure of helping him build the house. I might say, though, that that was more a case of we killed the bear, Papa shot it, though. He was the real power behind all the work. He did all the different trades, and the house today stands as a monument to his knowledge, workmanship, and what have you. I remember we went out and cut some chestnut logs and had them cut up into various dimensions. And Tom had some drop beam ceilings and paneling that was out of this world. That was before the chestnut blight hit in 26. Of course, George William Michael, I never knew because he died in infancy. John McDowell Jr., John McDowell Michael Jr., was as different as night and day. He was the type of fellow that made friends instantly, was happy-go-lucky, and never seemed to have a care in the world. But of course, I knew he did. John had a dirty trick played on him by the Army, because when World War I came along, he wanted to go to officer's training, but they turned him down, respiratory condition. But they turned right around and drafted him. And he went in as a private and went overseas and served in France. There he was gassed, burned, and everything else that can happen to you when the billet he had was shelled and caught on fire. For many, many months he was, we didn't know what had happened to him. He was in a hospital in various places, the latter part of the time he was in the army, he was in a hospital in England, and one of his favorite stories was how he tried to get Red Cross people to write his family a letter, and they wouldn't. They refused. I never felt the same toward the Red Cross since. But that's just the way it was. A notice came out in the paper that he had been slightly wounded in action along in August. And we didn't hear from him again until he came home right about Christmas. To say he was dilapidated and pathetic is just part of the story. He even had on the uniform that had been burned, singed, I guess would be a better word. That's all he had. He never got over the mustard gas that he was subjected to, but he made a good attempt, and he did get to the point where he could do something. Mostly mechanics work on automobiles, because he had been to state college, taken some training in the old A&E college before it became known as state college, state university or whatever. John was a great storyteller. He could sit all night and tell tales with the best. Didn't make any difference what about hunting, fishing, or anything else. Just entertaining stories, if nothing else. And everybody liked him. He played banjo and had a real good time of it. But he never was able to do much work after he got out of the army. I guess his downfall was when he married Lillian. She was Lillian Wilcox from Kernersville. And she didn't help him very much. Joe was a little bit on the serious side. That's Joseph Lewis Michael. He was very sincere. And he had trouble in school because of his eyes. In those days, anybody that could shoot a rifle, knock a squirrel's eye out with a .32 rifle, wasn't anything wrong with their eyes. But that proved to be absolutely wrong, because Joe had a terrific case of astigmatism that hurt him real badly. But he did join the officers training school at Camp Gordon, Augusta, and if the war hadn't ended right when it did, he would have gotten his commission. But he was mustered out before he got his commission, due to the armistice that was signed December 11, 1918. Joe, due to his eye trouble, spent very little time in school except for the old Bethel School near Woodrow. I went to a forestry school of some sort. I don't know the details of that. He married. Mary B. Harris, who at the time was a medical student. And they made a home at the old Lenore, on the old Lenore property. And he inherited the better part of the land that was divided to mother from the whole old home place, the Lenores. They had two children, Joe Jr. and Mary Lenore Michael. I failed to mention up there that John and Lillian had five children, two boys, John McDowell Michael III, and George Wilcox Michael. And three daughters, Mary Ellen Michael, Sarah Louise Michael, and Lillian Charlotte Michael. I have very little information on those members of the family. My only sister was Martha Elizabeth Michael, and she has developed, wrapped every one of us around her finger. She was nice to us. She knew how to handle all the boys, and they all thought she was queen of the tribe, so to speak. She was mighty good to me, I know. And I was very fortunate in one respect, that in later years I could return her favor after she suffered a stroke and needed someone to take care of her in Eatonton, North Carolina, when her children were so far away. She married Frank Wood, who was a surgeon, and they practiced medicine together in Marion, North Carolina, and then Pope was sequestered, I guess you'd call it, as an as a expert. And he had to go overseas. He took some work at some of the British universities and came back even after the invasion on D-Day, in which he participated, without mishap. They had two children, Frank Wood Jr. and Martha Michael Wood, known as Dew. I guess we'd have to say that Niff got the best whack at education. She went to Salem Academy, Salem College, then on to Columbia for a spell, back to the University of North Carolina for 2 years of medicine, and then to the University of Pennsylvania for medicine, intern, and so forth. I had the pleasure of being at Chapel Hill 2 of the years that Niff spent at the university. And I felt like I was richer on account of that experience. My next older brother was James Weston Michael. Jim, in other words. And I guess I'd have to say that due to the relative ages, I was closer to him than any of the other children in the family. He and I spent a good bit of time in Bingham together. He taught me to be a bugler. And we used to have lots of fun investigating things like snakes. One of our favorite was to catch rattlesnakes and put them in a box. Of course, Mother didn't think much of that idea. Jim was a right much of a thinker, though. If you didn't watch out, you got the idea that he was moody, but he really wasn't. He had a real nice personality when he wanted to show it. He went to Carolina for a while, took civil engineering, and he, like Tom, became a land surveyor. Jim was too young to get into the fracas when World War I came around. He was going to Bingham. But when World War II came along, he was bound and determined to get into something. He tried the Army, and they turned him down on account of his age. He tried the Navy, and they turned him down. But he was working for an admiral, retired admiral. And somewhere or another, he pulled some strings and got Jim into the Seabees. And Jim saw a lot of ragged service in the islands when we were engaged with the Japanese. He decided he didn't want to leave a wife and go in service. He didn't get married until after the World War II was over. And I'm afraid that he saw a lot of things in the islands over there that almost soured his nature. He was mighty serious about it. But a little bit later, he married Virginia Fleming Yancey. But, of course, that was too late for them to have a family, so they had no children. Jim wanted to be a minister, but I guess it was just ordained, so to speak, that he wouldn't have a chance. And I think this sort of granddaddy's gizzard a little bit. But all in all, I guess Jim and I had a lot of fun. I thought it was nice that I could help him in later years, because he needed somebody. Virginia had a massive stroke and was a vegetable for almost 15 years, which didn't improve Jim's situation at all. But as I say, I was lucky enough to help him with Virginia's estate, to some extent at least. Although I couldn't make a home for him after I retired. I was the next child that came along and was the baby of the family after Pat's death. I guess I'd have to say that I'm not too much impressed with what I have done, and I don't like to blow my own horn over nothing. But I think I can make a statement regarding all of the children, and mother and dad too, for that matter. As soon as I tell you about Pat. Pat was born as Patrick McDonough Michael. He was born in July 1908 and lived only a short time. Although I was quite young at his death, there are two separate pictures that I have involving Pat. and they are just as clear as if it had happened yesterday. One was, I remember at the lodge, Pat's little coffin, sitting on the dining room table. And I remember he looked awful white and still. I didn't know why exactly. The other picture is at the back door of the lodge, kitchen door to be exact. I remember seeing the carriage with two horses hooked to it. Somebody drove it. I don't know who now. But Mother and Dad were sitting on the seat in the back of the carriage. And Pat's coffin was on the floor of the carriage between them. They were going somewhere, and I didn't know why, and I didn't know why I wasn't going alone. Of course, the truth sank in after a long time, but I guess that was my first brush with death. I didn't know what it was or what it meant. At that age, I guess I wasn't supposed to. I must have been between 2 and 3 years old, as best I can figure. So, recollections are pretty scarce along about that time. I guess I was pretty resentful I must have been, because I didn't understand why we couldn't keep Pat. My next brush with death, as it were, was when Aunt Sally passed away. I remember I was roaming around the old house in Waynesville when Dad caught up with me and simply said, "Bill, it's time to tell Aunt Sally goodbye." He took my arm with a firm but gentle grip, and we walked down the hall into the parlor and stood beside Aunt Sally's casket. I had seen animals on the farm. I knew that there was such a thing as death amongst them, and I guess I accepted that, but this was too much. Somebody had robbed me personally. I felt nothing but turmoil. Something had been taken away from me that I dearly loved. and I resented it with all my being. It dawned on me that there my friend lay, but she couldn't speak to me. And that almost broke my heart. After a bit, Dad led me out of the parlor, and I say led because I couldn't see. I was sobbing so hard and crying. My eyes were so blurred I couldn't see where I was going. I felt like somebody had thrown a rock and shattered my glass house. That was the personal side of it. And in general, I felt like it just wasn't fair to take such a wonderful person away. I said up there somewhere that I thought I could make a statement that applied equally to all members of the family, including mother and dad. And it amounts to this. We were taught, starting when we were very small, that we should take a position before we did any arguing with people. In other words, we had to get informed first, decide which side of the question you wanted to support, and go from there. I think that a lot of people have accused us of being hard-headed, stubborn, and all that sort of thing. But actually, you can't argue with the fact that if you pick a side to that argument and are willing to stick by it, that's not too bad. It was far better to do that than to be mush-mouthed or mealy-mouthed, as the case may be, or be wishy-washy about a subject. If you didn't know anything about it, you had no business discussing it. If you did know something, know which is the right side and stick by it. That's just about how simple it is. There's hardly a day that goes by the toe doesn't remind me of how hard-headed I am. I'm not proud of it. I'm not ashamed of it. It just so happens that I think that there are too many people in the world that are too easily influenced by a few words. The whole subject has been written about a lot, and you hear reference made to the fact that nobody should ever try to defend a weak position. And I guess the old saying, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. It's pretty applicable. I have mentioned Chesapeake Lodge several times, and it might be well to put in a few words of description about what the house or home amounted to. On the first floor, we had the kitchen, pantry, a bathroom, a hall, entrance hall, and two large rooms. One was the dining room, and one was this old assembly hall for the club. And I believe I said we had a pool table in that assembly hall. The only heat in the lower part of the house, first floor, was the kitchen stove and two big fireplaces, one in the assembly hall and one in the dining room. The second floor provided for one bedroom over the kitchen, one bedroom over the pantry, and three bedrooms across the south side of the building. The first being Martha's room. The middle was Dad's and Mother's room, and the corner room, or the southeast corner, was for company. The east bedroom was for boys and company, and the west bedroom was the same for boys and all company. In addition, there was a rather large sitting room area with a potbelly stove in it, four-poster bed, and however many cots were required. The capacity of the place was very elastic. We could put up just about any number of people, and we did. In all, there were seven bedrooms in the house. The one over the kitchen had a back stairs entrance, and that was turned over to Bach. Bach was Tom Blaylock, who was just about both hands, so to speak. He was the right hand and the left hand, as far as the farm work, milking, and all the other jobs around the place were concerned. It certainly was a full-time job, and we gave him that room, and he lived as a member of the family at meal time and every other time, almost. He was quite a character. He had a bushy head of hair that looked like some sort of a spruce tree, a long beard and mustache. The beard came down to his belt. He looked like the old man in the mountains, I guess, more than anything else. But with all the comings and goings of the children and so forth, somebody had to act as a sort of an anchor to keep all the stock fed and cows milked and all the other things that had to be done. That left six bedrooms plus the big sitting room on the second floor. And somehow or another, all of the family and all of the visitors could be put up for the night, so to speak. The only heat on the second floor was box room got heat from the kitchen stove up through the floor, ceiling, or what have you, because there was a fire running most of the time in the stove, cook stove. There was a fireplace in Dad's and Mother's room, and a pot-bellied stove in the sitting room. That's all the heat there was on that floor. And you can imagine, there wasn't much dawdling around when people started to go to bed. They didn't play around if it was in the wintertime. And we did have some pretty severe winters in my book. I think the coldest winter we had, my recollection, was 12 below. Most everybody was very much surprised when they found out that we had inside plumbing. In fact, we had two bathrooms. One was, as I said, on the first floor, and one on the second floor. And if you had to have heat in there, you used a kerosene stove, that little portable stove that you lit up and carried around with you. The water supply was very good. Back of the house, up on the Sugarloaf Mountain, there was a free-running spring of very good water. So we put a barrel in there for storage in the spring, and then ran a pipe from there to the house about three-quarters of a mile away. About midway, we had another barrel for storage to get capacity stored up. The pressure on the second floor was nothing like we enjoy in the city water supply here, of course, but served its purpose. And beat all holler on the sponge bathing that you. It was very prevalent in those days.